When Donald Woods was about 19 years old, he thought he would be a lawyer. It was a logical step for the son of a South African trader who had done well in life. But the politics of Donald Woods' country took him first to journalism and then to the life of an activist and finally to exile from his own country. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with South African journalist and author Donald Woods. Welcome and thank you for your time. You said in Biko, one of your books, that all nationalist power is based on arithmetic. I take this to be the arithmetic that protects the few against the many. Is that so?
Yeah. You'll always find that where rulers are not confident of taking the majority along with them, they find all sorts of reasons why they and their few buddies should decide what happens, like in the Soviet Union for so many years. And in South Africa now for 350 years, the white minority has found all sorts of reasons why the blacks shouldn't have the vote.
Was this so in as early as 1652 when the Dutch and then Germans and French began to settle?
At first, they hadn't intended to make it a permanent settlement. So when they encountered the indigenous people, they kept them out through a series of thorn fences around where Cape Town is today. But that soon changed as more and more whites arrived, moved further into the interior, and in the process dispossessing the indigenous people. Mm-hmm. So they began to realize that they were there for good. And as they tried over the centuries to pretend they were part of the civilized world, so they had to find these formulas to explain why they weren't giving democratic rights to the majority. And they had a whole range of things like they are not educated, they are not ready for the vote. So it seemed really crude to deprive people of education and then not give them the vote because they didn't have education.
But this was well enough explained within the Afrikaner nationalist politic. It was accepted.
Demanded. An Afrikaner, white Afrikaners could not get anywhere in politics if they advocated a liberal democracy. It was the kiss of death for them. And so their leaders down the years, the first thing they had to do was show they were more racist than anyone else, or more convincingly racist. See, there is a difference. If you get a kind of nutcase guy saying he'll save white civilization by shooting all the blacks, the whites don't really believe that's practical. So they ditch him in favor of a guy who started using code language like, we want to preserve civilized standards, which meant we'll shoot them if we have to, but...
I want to ask you a very naive question, and just to see what your thinking is on it. The Dutch escaped their country because their church was the object of prejudice and discrimination, and because they were in danger. When the Dutch and then later the Huguenots, the Germans and French, settled in the Cape, the British decided that they wanted that area. They killed tens of thousands of the Boers, especially women and children, in terrible conditions in concentration camps. The naive question is, why doesn't a people learn when it is being so terribly discriminated against not to turn around and beat the other guy?
Yes, why indeed? I think one of my greatest heroes is a woman called Emily Hobhouse, and I'm astonished the world doesn't know more about her. She was, this may appear to be a digression, but it isn't. Mm. She was a young woman in Cornwall, in England, in about 1895, and from a very privileged background. Her father was a vicar in the church, and she was from a wealthy family, striking-looking person, and she was in her early 30s. And to make a long story short, she was a great campaigner. Any cause, like war, she was the first really powerful anti-war campaigner. Women's rights, she was with Emily Pankhurst and the others. Mm-hmm. And so then the Boer War started, and she began a campaign in Britain to try and stop Britain going on with the Boer War, because she could see what was happening to the 20,000 women and kids killed in the concentration camps. And she eventually bullied them into allowing her to go out there and bring bandages and medicines and things to these women and children. She bullied Lord Kitchener, who was the general out there, into giving up a troop train so she could take these bandages and things. And she she sort of terrorized the authorities, and eventually they were reduced to trying to physically wrap her in a blanket and put her on a ship back to England. And it's a wonderful story, so I won't go into great length, but the point she kept making is after the Boer War, the Boers adopted her as a sort of their favorite sort of English woman, and they named towns after her in South Africa. Then they named, inappropriately, a branch of the National Party, and finally, a submarine, one of South Africa's submarines. Can you imagine naming it for this anti-military woman? But the key to it was that when she was very old, she used to write letters to the Boer generals and leaders, and she said, I did not labor to free you from British oppression so that you could visit the same oppression upon the native peoples. Mm-hmm. And it relates to your question. Why don't peoples learn that what happens to them, that they shouldn't inflict on others what's happened to them? Human nature.
The answer is we don't know. Yeah. You weren't always an anti-apartheid activist.
No.
What happened in your life?
Well, you see, I was brought up, like us practically all white kids of my generation, to just accept that apartheid was normal, natural. As far as we were concerned, was how the world was, you know? You had servants, black servants. The only blacks you knew were there to pick up things for you or to polish your shoes or to, you know, be servants. Mm-hmm. And so this was it. And for the white minority, of course, it was the life of great privilege. And it was only when I started studying law in Cape Town, began to dawn on me, this might not seem such a very good thing. And it's hard to select any one influence. There were a couple of things. There was a lecturer I admired a lot who didn't preach at me, but he sort of was a bit like a psychoanalyst. He just kept making one re-examine oneself, justify why you had these beliefs. And suddenly standing up in a class full of sophisticated... I was a country boy from the Transkei. The Transkei is to South Africa what, I suppose you could say, the northwest of Alaska is to the whole United States. You know, when you mention you're from there, they say, wow, how exotic. And so I was sort of country hick, and to stand up in front of all these sophisticated students and then have to justify what are really very crude prejudices proved increasingly difficult. So that was one influence. I met a black American student. I'd never met blacks who sort of dressed and walked around like I did. And a crazy thing, which I don't know if non-South Africans can understand, but the fact that his accent was American, you know, like Gary Cooper and the film stars I was seeing, meant that accent wasn't a racial thing, you know, which is hardly an astounding, profound truth, but I met for the first time blacks who didn't speak like black Africans. Uh-huh. And I began to think, well, I suppose if you grew up in Buckingham Palace and you're black, you're going to talk like the Prince Charles or someone. And once you break that stereotype, the rest start crumbling, you see. You start realizing that we are shaped by environment, mm-hmm. you know, not by what color our eyes are or our skin. And that was another... And then finally, I was a not very devout, but fairly orthodox Catholic. And about that time, the Catholic Church in South Africa was coming to its very slow and seemingly reluctant conclusion that apartheid was immoral. So all of these influences started me re-evaluating it and finally rejecting it.
When you did that, what happened to your emotional relationship with your country?
It actually didn't change all that much because, and this is quite a profound lesson I learned, rejection of a system, no matter how evil, doesn't necessarily put you in the ranks of those getting rid of it. In other words, I stopped supporting apartheid, but I certainly didn't go out with the other students who were demonstrating against it or signing petitions. In fact, I thought they were a bit sort of sentimental, you know.
Sentimental?
Yes, yeah, sort of, what the hell, all this fancy stuff. You know, I'd rather go to rugby games or cricket games, not marching. I've never liked chanting. I've never liked people chanting slogans. I still don't like it. I've led demonstrations on Harvard campus now because when I got there, the black student said, you know, you're an anti-apartheid leader. Will you lead our demonstration? This was about 12 years ago against, they wanted Harvard to divest. And I said, yeah, but no chanting. And they said, okay. And they looked at each other. And so I led this huge thousands of Harvard students And one of my great friends, Dennis Boot, is a black South African. And he said, okay, you got to chant. I said, no way. He said, you got to. See, the TV camera stuck in your face. You got to chant, end the lies, cut the ties, divest now. Well, you can do it two or three times, but you go on for 30 minutes saying, end the lies, cut the ties, divest now. You start feeling a bit stupid. You know? And so I think for that reason, I wasn't over keen on demonstrating and ever. And so I didn't really turn against the country as such or an identification with it. That happened later.
This is Donald Woods, our guest on this edition of Conversations. Donald Woods has a number of books to his credit, the first starting in 1977. His book, Biko, was written while he was under ban in his house, not allowed to leave his house in South Africa, not allowed to speak with more than one person at a time outside the intimate members of his family, not allowed to write, and certainly not allowed to be published. The book Biko came out under those conditions and was slipped out of the country to his publisher in England. A number of books since then, to his credit. We're talking today with Donald Woods, longtime editor of the New London Daily Dispatch in South Africa. There is a sense among Afrikaners that they are blessed by God, it seems to me, I have read in any case, that their belief system is one that the deity would approve of. Is that...
It's not so true anymore, but certainly it was widely believed up till probably the mid-60s, late 60s, and it was the underpinning of the apartheid policy. They believed that they had divine authority to do this. And it rested on a fairly crazy assumption, which you would recognize if you travel, as I do, usually most years I come to the United States. And you know, at airports, you occasionally meet groups of zany campaigners or something or other, and they've got the same light in their eye, you know. Mm-hmm. They've either decided that all copperware is poisoned by the communists or something, or that there's a conspiracy to subvert water supplies or something. In the case of the Nationalist Afrikaners, they believed that they were the New Testament version of the Old Testament Israelites, which is a great irony because they were very anti-Semitic at the same time. But they believed, in a sense, that they were the new chosen people, chosen by God to go into the dark continent of Africa and to bring civilization and civilized values and Christianity. And in that process, to do the most unchristian things you could imagine.
Yeah, it's a fairly benevolent thought.
There is a theory, which I might run by you, and if you think it's too crazy, just check it out. I think there may be a grain of truth in it, but most of it sounds too wild to me. And that is, and if in the process of doing it in shorthand, I do it wrong, I'm sorry, but the two great waves of colonization in the world were into South America by Catholic countries, Portugal, Spain, etc., and into Africa by partly Catholic countries, such as Portugal and Spain, but mostly Britain, Germany, France, Belgium, etc., mostly British and French. I mean, few people know even to this day that of the 52 countries in Africa, 23 are French-speaking, and the remainder are English-speaking. So, now, religiously, when the Catholics got to South America, they did not come from democratic countries. Spain and France were autocratic, were monarchies. And the religion had no notions of equality of human beings at all. So when they got to South America and saw what they regarded as savages, you know, savage peoples, they had no problem with converting them, sometimes forcibly, and drawing them into what they saw as the true church and everything. Whereas the Dutch, who arrived in 1652 in Cape Town, where Cape Town is now, they arrived there from a country which was fiercely democratic, and it's Calvinism had this great thing about the equality of peoples, and all people are equal. They saw these savages and said, all men are equal, that creature is not equal to me, therefore that cannot be a man.
Ah, oh, yes, that's where that comes from.
Yes, cannot be a man. And so we're able for close to 300 years to justify theologically the treatment of the subhuman species. See? Now that is this, you know, that's a theory I've heard. There may be a grain of truth in it. But today that belief is not widely held.
But the pattern still holds. Yeah. This is Conversations. We're talking with Donald Woods. In the last couple of years, there has been an effort to reform the Nationalist Party. Are these, in your mind, great strides or small steps, given the source?
They are giant strides.
Giant strides.
You know, I wasn't able to go back till 1990. I'd been away close to 14 years. About 12 years at that stage. And I've been back since six times. And the great difference is, when I'd left South Africa, every phone call I made was listened into. Everywhere I went, I was followed. And there was that sense of constant surveillance. This time when I arrived, that was the biggest change. You didn't get this feeling that you were being followed or listened to. And then I got to the exit of Johannesburg Airport and I saw three black soldiers. Now, there were no such things as black soldiers when I left, you see. Mm. And armed with automatic rifles. Blacks were never allowed to carry arms. So these are tremendous changes. Now, what brought them about? There are lots of theories. I believe the main thing was the shock. You see, shock is one of the best educators. You could spend centuries trying, as indeed the blacks of South Africa did, trying to appeal to the better instincts of the whites. I mean, the African National Congress was founded just on 80 years ago, had this policy of non-violence, peaceful marches, passive resistance, etc., and got nowhere. Then suddenly, militant leaders get up and say, we're going to have to fight. And suddenly, people start listening. And it's one of the worst things about human nature. And if you look throughout Africa, or probably Germany, or everywhere, is this: the fact that violence works. It's a terrible thing. Violence, or the threat of violence, works better than appeals to reason. You saw it even with the tormenting or the persecution of Jews for centuries. Suddenly, when the state of Israel started producing these tough-looking soldiers, there was a change of attitude towards Jews worldwide. I think it is truly one of the awful aspects of the human nature, that violence seems to be more effective.
We think you're kidding until you actually bring the gun out.
Yeah. So, and so, when in South Africa, the whites for years would get these petitions and peace marches saying, please give us rights. And they'd sort of smile and say, yes, very interesting. And then suddenly when they found they were confronted with a guerrilla war of a kind, a limited war, plus the onslaught from the rest of the world economically through sanctions, that shock education was the valuable thing. And when I got back there, I found literally different people. I was taken in to meet President de Klerk. Now, in the old days, I would have met him. I'd been in handcuffs, I guess. And they want to be liked, you see. They want to be acceptable in the human race again.
Is that new?
No, they always wanted that, but now they're beginning to realize what they have to do to get it. That's what's new. And so I think, yeah, it's giant strides. This does not mean they're where they have to be yet, but it means they've moved a huge distance from where they had been before.
You have said, you've written, that Stephen Biko was the greatest man you ever knew. I have listened to other people on videotapes saying that when he was present, even if you couldn't see him, you could feel his hugeness, the size of his spirit was so great.
He was remarkable. He was also, and it's never easy to put into words the effect of people like that. You know, you have to experience them to appreciate what they're like. But just to give you an idea, after I'd gone through Cape Town University and, as far as I was concerned, no longer supported apartheid, I was intellectually opposed to the system, but I was not emotionally engaged against it, I believe, fully, till I met Steve Biko. And where the difference came about was when you are white, and I don't care where you live, whether it's Alaska or Hawaii or South Africa, whatever, white people cannot ever fully perceive what it's like to be black in a discriminatory society where there's racism in all its forms. You actually have to be looking out of black eyes or out of a black skin to have a full appreciation of what that is. That does not mean you can't get quite close if you know the right people. I suppose if you met a Martin Luther King and got friendly with him, they start educating you into looking out of, as close as whites can, to looking out of black eyes. And then you start seeing things you didn't notice before. And I'm sure you could say this over a whole range of issues, of feminism, everything else, mm-hmm. is once you get something of that insight and you start looking out through those eyes and through those emotions. Just to give some examples now, I was the other day here in the U.S., I saw an article about Denzel Washington, as the actor who played Steve Biko and now Malcolm X. And it was an article praising him. He's a tremendous actor. And the writer said, Denzel Washington is one of the best black actors in the United States. And I immediately thought, I've never seen Paul Newman or Robert Redford described as one of the best white actors. Mm-hmm. So you start picking up little things like that. Another thing is you see headlines, black on black violence in South Africa. And you think, well, listen, you know, 98% of Africans are black. And so most violence is going to be black on black violence. Now, in Europe, you get German soccer fans stabbing Italian soccer fans or Dutch or English, killing each other. And yet you never see a headline, white on white violence in Europe. So those are the kinds of things you start noticing when you learn from people like Steve Biko. Huh.
Powerful figure in your life especially. This is Conversations. We're talking today to Donald Woods. He spoke of Denzel Washington playing Steve Biko. It was in the movie Cry Freedom, which came out in 1987?
Yes, 88.
Yeah. By Richard Attenborough as the producer and director, a film that was filmed in Zimbabwe.
That's right.
Is it possible to say what produced Stephen Biko? Was he brilliant on his own?
He was a one-off. I visit his mother and sister and family now, and we all agree that there was no process that shaped him. And I think it was like a Mozart. I think if Mozart had been a lumberjack in the forests of North America, he would have probably written marvelous music. I think if you have a touch of genius, that's going to be there no matter. Mm. The form of it may be shaped by your environment or your circumstances, but you're a one-off for that time, I think. And in his case, what was very good about him was, a bit like my lecturer at university, he didn't sort of bash you with figures and facts and arguments. When I first met him, I found him quite scary, a forbidding figure. And his manner, he was the opposite to people like Jesse Jackson. The black American style is far more flamboyant of speech, and the cadences, you know. Uh-huh. I love that one, who's the chap down in Washington. He was the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, and he used to say, we may not all have come over on the same kind of ship, but we're all in the same boat now. Drawing the distinction between the slave boats and the Mayflower. Mm-hmm. But Steve Biko's style was very different, very understated, very powerful. And he didn't always, although when I first met him I found him quite forbidding, he'd then keep quiet and I'd start find myself babbling, you know. And I went in there and it was the first time I met a black South African in my own country who was not only my equal, but my superior. I suddenly realized I'm out of my depth with this guy. And the people who were with him, Dr. Rampele, Malusi Mpumlane, a few of the ones I met there, who I've remained very close to, these were extremely bright people. Now, it's not that there weren't such people in South Africa as a rule, but apartheid had worked in the sense that it kept us apart. And when I went back and told my wife, I've just met these guys up the road, and wow, they are very different. She too got excited. We were invited up to meet them again, and we realized that there were pockets of these people all over the country, but the police, only the security police knew about it. Most of the whites we spoke to found this very hard to believe, because the only blacks they knew would be carrying their coffee in, or they might be very grey-haired, sort of respectable old clergymen, sort of Uncle Tom figures. Mm-hmm. So this was in itself profoundly educational, to meet a superior in your country who was black.
Dr. Rompele said she thought Steve Biko was one of the few people who could save South Africa. Yeah. Was she right? Is that true in your mind?
Oh, yes, in the sense that I remember telling the then Prime Minister about it, and the Minister of Justice and Police, if you'd only talk to this guy, and save us all a lot of trouble. Because I learned a lot from him, you can. They didn't want to hear that. And she was right, because if they had got together with him then, the last 15 years of bloodshed could largely have been, maybe not all of it averted, but most of it could have been, I'm sure. Now they're doing it. Now they're sitting talking to the very people they described as horrible terrorists, murderers, and now they're meeting the real people, and they could have done this with Steve Biko 15 years ago. Horrible waste of opportunity and lives.
And time. This is Conversations. We're talking today with South African journalist Donald Woods. As he said, he was first allowed to return to his native country after escaping it in 1977. In 1990, after Nelson Mandela was freed from prison, a number of people who were living under banishment, either in their country or had escaped, as did Donald Wood, were allowed to return. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. I have two questions at once. The first one, I think, is about the ears beginning to open. Is this once again absolutely of necessity? Does the Nationalist Party, the Nationalist Government, realize that they have no choice but to listen to black leaders? Or is it a change of mind and a change of heart?
I think it's a change of perception, which is bringing in its wake a genuine change of heart. It's sort of a form of what happened to me, but different in style. What they've done is, after a lifetime of regarding blacks essentially as enemies, now through necessity they've had to sit down and talk to them, and in the process have been surprised to find how much in common they've got, because and they've been impressed against their inclinations to find that these are remarkable people. And so that upsets their stereotypes. See? Now, one great thing about stereotypes is once one cracks, it goes all the way. It really, the whole thing comes apart. Because if you can't found your belief on that rock-hard foundation anymore, there's nothing secure, you see. So you've got to reevaluate the whole philosophy if you carry it through to its logical conclusion. So I think that what became a necessity then developed into new perceptions and are going on. I think the process is going on day after day, week after week, as they carry on the negotiation.
And it would only make sense that as more communication opens up, that more communication will open
up. That's right.
The question I had that came up at the same time was about the separate populations, you discovering to your surprise and delight that there was such a person as Stephen Biko or Dr. Rompele. And others. Was it because of the resettlements that there was no interaction other than from servant to master?
It was, you know, it was a complex society as a creation of the white settlers. The first ones arrived in 1652, and they were mostly Dutch. And then my ancestors arrived in 1820, and they were British and Irish. And what they did was sort of try and create little pockets of Europe in Africa. And, of course, what made the whole thing work was that the part of Africa we live in looks like Europe. The part where the settlers landed near Port Elizabeth looked like the South Downs of Hampshire in England and Sussex, you see. So they really thought it was a home from home. And it took some time before they realized it wasn't quite the same. But in the whole process of fastening their influence on that place, The whites created huge divisions. First of all, there was division among the whites to begin with, because we kids were brought up very prejudiced against Afrikaners, and Afrikaans kids were prejudiced against English-speaking whites. And if you realize that the white population, which is about 5 million, is split two-thirds, roughly, Afrikaans-speaking, one-third, the minority, English-speaking, so that we had to learn Afrikaans at school. If you wanted to graduate from high school, you had to learn this language, which most of us were prejudiced against because we considered these people inferior. you know, it's this deep belief that God is an Anglo-Saxon. And so I found, strange enough, that I liked the Afrikaans language. All my friends around school were saying, oh, it's not a language, it's a disease. I just liked the sound of it in time, and I liked speaking. I still enjoy speaking it. And then on top of that, there was the black culture, which was the Nguni culture mostly, which was Xhosa, Zulu, Swazi, Ndebele mostly. And we grew up in the Xhosa area. And in a sense, I was more at home in that than in Afrikaans or English, because I was the only white kid for miles around, you know, hundreds of thousands of black kids. So my playmates, up to the age of six, we spoke their language, not mine. Although I always ended up being the sheriff, and they were the bad guys. It was really feudal. So there were these three cultures, and still are today. But perceptions are changing now. Just think how much easier it would have been right from the start if we had learnt Xhosa in school as well as Afrikaans. Mm-hmm. And so we'd have had the three cultures. And I think a country with three cultures is like the Swiss, is thrice blessed. And if you look on it as a thing of opportunities rather than an encumbrance, I think the Canadians, those who resist the bilingual thing, are doing themselves down. They, you know, have got access to the two greatest cultures probably in the world, I think, the English and the French. And yet I've met Canadians who resent being expected to learn French. So.
Mm-hmm. I want to listen to you a bit on the subject of reforms. There is a point, I think it is in Cry Freedom, yes it is, where you and Kevin Kline playing you and Denzel Washington playing Steve Biko are sitting with some other friends of Steve Biko's and of yours around the table. And one man, I don't know who it was, says to you, you think reform is inviting us to eat at your table with your silver and your plates. I say it is an African table, and it must be swept clean.
Yes, that's right.
The difference between reform and transformation.
That's right. It's it was a radical difference between this belief of the whites that all they had to do was turn blacks into honorary whites, and all would be dandy. And the blacks are saying, no, it's the other way around. Actually, we belong here more than you do, and you've got to adapt to us. In fact, both are wrong, I now believe, at the ripe old age of nearly 60. I think that both are wrong, but the blacks are more right than the whites. You see, the whites are obviously wrong because they were the interlopers. On the other hand, I don't believe continents or countries belong only to the people who originally were there. It's crazy that you'd be fixing statically the whole world. On the other hand, I think the other position is wrong too, to imply that he who calls the tune has to be the one who's been there longest. That can lead to some awful arguments like in the Middle East. I believe that we've got to realize we each section, each group, each culture, each race, if you like, has so much to contribute and so much to learn from others. And we're in this together. We share countries, we share continents, we share the planet.
This is a very optimistic view, that we will share the continent.
We've got to. I meet people who are pessimistic about this, that, and the other, the ozone layer and AIDS. And so, you know, the human race has been visited with so many frightening challenges. And so far, the progress is in a forward direction. There were, you know, if you go back to the bubonic plagues, and if you go back to slavery, you can see how the human race always reluctantly, always hesitantly but lurchingly ending up going in the right direction, ending up doing the right thing. And sometimes through cataclysms, wars, whatever. So I think we're increasingly getting the perception that that racism, that prejudice is not only wrong, but stupid, unproductive, expensive. It holds back countries. Mm-hmm. Bad for your health.
Mm-hmm. Expensive. That's one of the reasons that businessmen in Cape, at least I've heard, in Cape Town are beginning to argue for reform.
Sure. I mean, you work out the logistics of it. We had this crazy thing called the Factories Act back in the early 70s, where every new factory had to have separate toilets for each section of the, each racially designated section. Now, there was white, blacks, coloureds, and Asiatics, male and female in each case. So you had eight categories toilet-wise for factory workers. Now, work out the expense of that. Mm-hmm. Think every building had to have separate elevators so whites wouldn't be contaminated through going in the same elevator as blacks. Think of the sheer cost of putting extra elevator shafts in. So that's why, as I say, advisedly, it's not any craziness, it's expensive craziness.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the question of backlash? For hundreds of years, but actually officially since 1948, there has been a government that has put its whole weight on a population that is huge.
Yeah.
Those people are angrier and angrier. What about the Afrikaners' fear and the other white South African fears that there will simply be a black horde rising up against them?
They've got the same fear, but it's not as practically expressible as it used to be. And the reason for that is because blacks now have access to weapons too. So what before was this tiny minority of the whites, who in turn were a tiny minority, who, because they had access to arms, could voice such prejudices quite openly. Mm-hmm. We're not going to let you savages take over. Now, you know, it's a terrible... You know, the word kaffir means what nigger used to mean in the US. There's the sick joke in South Africa. What do you call a kaffir with a machine gun? The answer is boss.
Aye.
See, now, if you're an old racist who's ready to shoot blacks to show tough, and you encounter 10 guys all with the same weapon you've got, and they're saying, what was that you were saying? That sort of talk starts fading away, the realities of the situation. And that's what I call the educational value of shock. Suddenly the shock is that you're not running the show anymore. The shock is that you're not the only one who can express views like that anymore. Mm-hmm. And along with that growing perception comes the perception that you just can't do it anymore. And that is the first step towards an accommodation with reality.
So your optimism and life experience tells you that there will be accommodation before there is some dreadful mayhem.
Well, the timing of it, I'm not so sure about. Let me say, I don't think, I mean, only a fool would deny South Africa's got huge problems ahead of it. It's got huge tragedies ahead of it. But not the main issue anymore. The main issue died the moment Nelson Mandela walked out of that prison. The main issue of apartheid was stone cold dead from that moment. The rest is just wrapping up the body. Now, therefore, I believe...
Because they had threatened never to let him out?
Oh, they knew that from the moment... You see, they knew that if they didn't let him out, they were dead. That if they let him out, they're going to be severely wounded. So it was really... it was the symbolic end of centuries of trying to turn the clock back. Now, today, I'm pessimistic in the short term. Of course, there are going to be more killings. There's going to be more violence. Flare-ups, probably more local than anything. But in the long term, I'm optimistic. They're going to get through this. They're going to negotiate a peaceful settlement. They're going to get a democratic constitution within probably 2 years.
Oh, that's very quick.
Yeah. Well, they've got to. It's like, what's the old Indian proverb? He who mounts the tiger fears to dismount. So once you're riding on the back of a tiger, you've got to ride that thing. You can't get off.
This is Conversations. Once again, we're talking with South African journalist Donald Woods. Donald, I'm abashed to say that the piece of paper that said the title of your autobiography is not with me.
Oh, Asking for Trouble.
Asking for Trouble, that's right. And that was in 1986.
Yes, that was really much more fun to write than the Biko book, because Biko book's about tragedy, and Asking for Trouble was about fun. Uh-huh. About what I must say, I've had a very enjoyable life and lots of adventure. And people sometimes kindly introduce me when I'm on the lecture tour, in the US especially, as someone who suffered terribly in exile. And I have to say, no, I've had a great time in exile.
Donald Woods with us on Conversation. I must say, Asking for Trouble is a marvelous book. It begins in the Transkei when he is a little boy and continues further forward with discussions of his mom and dad and friends and family. And it's Asking for Trouble, good book by Donald Woods. Now, talk to me about the leaders now in Black Africa, Black South Africa. Nelson Mandela is a man who spent years of his life in prison and is getting older.
Yeah.
Buthelezi is from the Inkatha movement, is more willing to live side by side than perhaps Nelson Mandela is.
I'm not sure that's how I'd sum them up.
Okay, let me just ask then. I'm thinking the three main figures are Bishop Tutu, Nelson Mandela, and Buthelezi. Are those the three main figures to begin?
It conveys the wrong impression if you put those guys all on one level.
All right.
You know, it's like it's like putting a really towering figure next to others who may be very eminent in their own domain, but are not on that level. See, Mandela is on his own peak there. He's the George Washington of South Africa, because for so many reasons, and he's to every extent that we can determine in the absence of voting. He has got by far the hugest following, including from quite a number of whites. Mm-hmm. Now, when you Desmond Tutu also has a huge following. Desmond Tutu is up there, I think, with Nelson Mandela. Buthelezi is a regional leader in Northern Natal.
Zulu leader, Zulu chief.
Well, if you say Zulu leader, that's also misleading, because my guess would be in an election today, more Zulus would vote against him than would vote for him.
Oh.
You see, people believe that the tribal thing, rift runs so deeply that the Zulus will vote for Zulu and the Xhosas for Xhosa. But actually, if you look at the African National Congress, which is the biggest organization, I think there are more Zulus in the ANC than there are in the Inkatha Zulu Party. But we'll only know when there's an election. And I mean, I'm not here to label Chief Buthelezi a charlatan or anything. I don't think he is that. But I think he's very much a lightweight compared with these other people we're talking about, partly because of the regionalism of his politics.
I'm interested, if I can just kind of insert myself for half a second, that it is distance that breeds the misconceptions.
Well, it's also, you see, don't forget you had, up until 1990, one of the most highly funded propaganda operations by the South African government. It's over $100 million was spent on misinforming Americans and British. To put it shortly, their strategy, which made a lot of sense from their point of view, was they wanted to prevent sanctions vote in the UN. And the two countries in the Security Council which had vetoing authority to stop sanctions, in fact, that had stopped sanctions for 11 years, was the US and Britain. Mm. So they had to keep trying to tell Americans, don't stop vetoing this, because if you do, the communists are going to take over in South Africa,
right.
And motherhood and apple pie and the flag will be burnt and all that stuff. And Chief Buthelezi suited them very well as the moderate. Now, what he was saying was moderate, but it implies that what Mandela and them were saying was not moderate, and I think it's even more moderate. Bishop Tutu, I think, is the most wonderful man, and I know him very well. And what Buthelezi was doing, which American businessmen liked, was to say we mustn't have sanctions, because they didn't want sanctions, because they were making a few bucks out of trade and investment. Now, Mandela and Tutu were saying we must have sanctions, because if we don't, many more lives will be lost in this conflict. And I think they were right. So finally, we got the sanctions, but the carryover from that was that many Americans believe that Buthelezi is right up there with Mandela in stature. And that's because of the South African propaganda operation over so many years.
Well, I want to ask about sanctions. There was an argument made that, and the simplest way to put it is that if you starve a fat man, he will lose weight. If you starve a thin man, he will die. It's a very compelling argument against sanctions and disinvestment.
If you're starving him of poison, you may save him. You see, what the black South Africans are saying is, we're a majority, but we have no arms, we have no power, we haven't got economic empowerment, and we're not even allowed to organize. It's fine to talk of trade unions in, you know, somewhere in the States or Europe. You can lift a telephone and speak. We're not allowed to communicate certain things. Black unions at that stage weren't even legal. And then even when they became legal, there wasn't that freedom of movement about South Africa that you could just suddenly call a meeting and everyone would go to it. So what they were saying is, we want a level playing field. Mm-hmm. Now, what the watching world is doing, not providing a level playing field, is to keep providing huge tax revenues to the white minority. See, every dollar invested in South Africa, no matter for what, about just over a third of it. I used to illustrate this to students. I said, if you had scissors, you'd cut just past the ear. And that would be going to the South African government through tax revenues. And so what the blacks were saying is, we don't want you to get involved on our side much as we'd like it, but stop helping our oppressor. Then the white businessman in wherever, San Francisco, says, but I'm doing this in your interest. Mm-hmm. And the black man says, don't you think I'm the victim? I know what's in my interests. So it was a question of, was investment there doing more harm than good? Black said the tax revenues generated by it, plus the encouragement, the morale boost to the white minority of knowing that the world would not veto, that the US and Britain would not veto, that was a powerful psychological boost to them. Once that ended, apartheid ended. Because they suddenly got the message, we're on our own.
Nobody changes until they get very uncomfortable.
It's the twisting of the arm, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, you had it in your country. If Abe Lincoln had not stood firm, what on earth would have happened there? And it involved tragic loss of life. That was probably the most costly war ever fought in history. But in the absence of it, how many more lives would have been lost? And I think that's why the analogy about if you starve a thin man, if what you're starving him of is arsenic, then it's okay.
Then it's all right. We're talking with Donald Woods. Alan Payton wrote in Cry the Beloved Country, he has a minister say, my fear is that by the time the whites turn to loving, the blacks will have learned to hate.
Yeah.
As an optimistic man, can you analyze that thought?
Yes, I think it was a very valid warning and was almost being borne out at the time apartheid legislatively ended. I think, though, that there's a far greater danger in South Africa. But first I want to deal with this one. The danger you're talking of is the blacks turning to hatred before the whites have turned to love. Mm. In other words, generations of humiliation have bred such deep resentment. And, you know, if you doubt this happening, imagine yourself. The analogy I use, I never go to these extremes like imagine what it's like to be shot or starved or beaten up. But take a simple thing like seeing your mother or father, say your father, stopped by the police in the street and asked to produce his passbook, and then being humiliated because he hasn't got the right document stamp in it, being treated like an infant, cuffed around maybe. What does that do to you? You never forget things like that. You think, I'm going to get someone for that. So, I think there's a lot of maybe subliminally or maybe subconsciously held back, but a mass of anger still simmering there. But I think the greater danger is in the dynamics of the political situation creating expectations that can't be met. So you have the white leaders for so many years said, we will protect the whites from black majority control. Of course, that's impossible. They can't do it. So the whites then suddenly feel terribly exposed, terribly fearful. On the black side, black man hears Nelson Mandela saying, we're going to free you. You're going to be as free as the white man. Subconsciously thinks that means I'll have the Mercedes and the house and all that goes with freedom. And this is going to lead, it's a bit like the Soviet Union. After all those years of crazy economic system, suddenly they've had less than 1 year of what's called the free market setup, and they expect it all to come right in a month or two.
Yeah.
And that's my greatest fear for South Africa, is what happens to leaders like Nelson Mandela and others when, after a year in power, their followers don't noticeably, massively see improved circumstances. Because they can't. It's an impossibility to do it in a short time or on a large scale like that.
This is an odd question, but is an answer to that frustration the kind of black consciousness movement that Steve Biko wanted?
No. The black consciousness movement was a phase in South African history, which I think ended successfully in the middle 1970s. Mm-hmm. Black consciousness worked from the moment that the kids in Soweto stood up and resisted the police. There is a small, very small movement, group, call it what you will, in South Africa today, which claims to be carrying on the black consciousness tradition, but they're not. I mean, Steve Biko was dead before they were even formed. And also, a lot of the things they are propounding now were things he wrote as a 21-year-old student in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. How many of us would want to be thought of our life political philosophy trapped within what we thought at the age of 21, you know? So I don't think that black consciousness is any longer, has any more answers to give South Africa. I think what we now need in South Africa, apart from the obvious rejection of all forms of racism, is a realistic grasp of what economic steps have to be taken to start redressing the balance. Because you can't say to black South Africans, okay, we got rid of apartheid and we're all equal now.
Mm.
You can't. I mean, that's been the trouble in the US. I was quite horrified when I began to realize that people here thought that once Martin Luther King was dead and the civil rights legislation was passed, the problem is solved. It's only 50% of it. Because legislative equality is only part of the story. When you've had economic disadvantagement for hundreds of years, you don't suddenly make everyone equal next Tuesday by passing a law. So it's the same in South Africa. We have to redistribute the resources of the country, and that cannot be done by strokes of the pen or committees or fancy formula.
Time.
Time and hard work.
Enlightened leadership?
Leadership is the greatest need, and this is the thing. You know, you've hit on something which I think not only us, but you and the Brits and the whole darn world needs. And I always think of great leadership is such a rare quality. And it's a quality of enabling nations to do what was thought not possible. There are a few examples in history. I think Franklin Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, to take the Winston Churchill in Britain. In Churchill's case, there was this little island with the might of the German Air Force, with 3-4 times as many aircraft, and they shot them out of the sky,
mm-hmm.
Through belief that they would not be beaten.
We will not fail.
Yeah. Then you got, in the US, Abe Lincoln had to find, I think it was $300,000 every month to pay the Union Army. And in those days, that was a fortune. They didn't have any money. I think if we can find out how he wangled that, we can learn a lot of secrets. And what we've been starved of for years in the West over the last 12 to 14 years is leadership. So much so, I mean, after Operation Desert Storm, I think Mr. Bush had a golden opportunity to say, okay, on the riding on the crest of this, we tackle the deficit, now we tackle this and that and that, and I think people would have gone with him. Unfortunately, though, we seem to either have people who, if they've got the momentum of popularity, don't have the leadership to go with it, or others who've got the leadership ideas, like Jimmy Carter, but are not good at marshalling people to go in with it. Mm. So the people who've got both are rare.
Are you going home to South
yeah,
Africa?
Yeah, well, I've started sort of building the bridges now. We've got 5 kids, and they've made a life in Britain. But when we all went back, it was very interesting to see how quickly they took to the beaches. And also when the World Cup soccer's on, they always root for any African team, which to me is a good sign. I don't care whether it's Cameroon or Algeria or Zambia. If it's African, that's the one team they root for. And so I think we're going to increasingly live in both countries. And my ideal would be to get a job at the South African Embassy in London so that I'm near the rugby grounds and the cricket grounds, but I get home often. And to live in both countries. like that.
And do you feel fully welcome now?
Yeah, I was astonished. Well, I knew, you see, the black township, the black areas, I got a marvelous welcome back. I thought the reception in the white areas would be hostile. But it was surprisingly, even from some fairly right-wing guys who used to resent me a lot, in fact, some of them actually walked up to me and said, we should have listened to people like you in time. Now, that I didn't expect. So it was great homecoming.
Huh. Once a troublemaker, not always a troublemaker.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I want to tell you, this has been quite an honor, personally.
Oh, I've enjoyed yakking away.
Thank you.
As you can tell, I enjoy speaking.
Yes, and do it well. This has been Donald Woods with us today on Conversations. Once again, his autobiography, Asking for Trouble, is a lovely book, still in print, findable. Biko was the first book about the life and detention and trial and death of Stephen Biko, a very affecting piece of work. South African Dispatches, is that the...
Yes,
the name of the last?
That's no, I've done about six altogether, but those three are the ones that would give people an idea of the
major
country
books.
Best.
All right. There's also a look at the making of Cry Freedom with Richard Attenborough, and then, of course, there is the movie and videotape, Cry Freedom, about Donald Woods, his friend Stephen Biko, and the events that encircled their lives. I'm Susan McGinnis. You have been with us on Conversations. Our guest on this edition, South African journalist Donald Woods. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And I hope you'll join me again next week.